Now it's time for the Daily Service. It's led this morning by the Reverend Claire Jaquis. Here on Radio 4 FM, it's our Book of the Week. Drawing upon his experience as a performer and his background as a scholar, the acclaimed tenor Ian Bostridge reads from his new book on Schubert's masterpiece Winter Journey. The song cycle for voice and piano, inspired by the poems of Wilhelm Müller, was first published in 1828. The episode opens with Song 5, Der Lindenbaum.
The Lindenbaum, the lime tree, is deeply embedded in European and more specifically in German culture. Walter von der Vogelweide, one of the greatest German poets of the High Middle Ages, wrote a song sometime in the late 12th or early 13th century which crystallizes the association between love and the linden. Under the linden tree on the open field, where we two had our bed, you still can see, lovely both, broken flowers and grass. On the edge of the woods in a vale, Tandarade sweetly sang the nightingale. If the associations between the linden and romantic love are of striking and obvious relevance to Schubert's song, the political resonances too should not be forgotten. Linden trees were planted in many settlements in German-speaking lands, in a custom dating back to pre-Christian times. Village meeting places, these Dorflinden, village lindens, were a symbol of community, and indeed of Germanness, an aura only intensified by the holding of assemblies and judicial courts under their branches. The dreams the dreamer dreams in this song might well be of an idealised past in which Germans of all sorts governed themselves under the linden tree, free from foreign interference or bureaucratic oppression. Nature is at the heart of the romantic literary tradition from which both Müller and Schubert emerged, and many, many of Schubert's songs conform to the classical romantic pattern, which is to be found, for example, in Coleridge's great linden tree poem, This Lime Tree Bower, My Prison. A delight comes sudden on my heart, and I am glad as I myself were there. Nor in this bower, this little lime tree bower, have I not marked much that has soothed me. Pale beneath the blaze hung the transparent foliage, and I watched some broad and sunny leaf, and loved to see the shadow of the leaf and stem above, dappling its sunshine. How different is this tree, however, from Müller and Schubert's whispering tempter?
Seine Zweige rauschten, als riefen sie mir zu.
And its branches rustled as if it was calling out to me. Come here to me, old chap. Here you find your rest.
Nature
in Winterreiser is very differently conceived. We're presented with a succession of images of a hostile nature, sometimes brute, stupid nature, sometimes nature personified as something sinister or malicious. The Lindenbaum branches tempt the wanderer in this song to lie down and freeze to death. Will-o'-the-wisps will lure him into dangerous places. The ice will mock him by painting illusory leaves on window panes. That very personification, though, is pushed to the limit and hence essentially satirical in a later song, Rückblick, Backwards Glance, where the reality of birds dislodging snow from roofs onto the wanderer's head is poetically transformed into the ludicrous image of crows throwing snowballs at his hat from every house. We end up with the vision of winter as monstrously indifferent. This, surely, is one of the lessons the wanderer learns in the course of Winterreise. Song 10. Rast. Rest.
In eines Kühlers engem Haus hab Obdach ich gefunden.
In the cramped house of a charcoal burner I found refuge. But my limbs won't rest, their wounds burn so much. You too, my heart, in battle and storm, so wild and so daring, you feel in the stillness, for the first time, your worm stirring with hot pang.
Mein Herz in Kampf und Sturm so wild und so verwegen, fühlst in der Stille ist deinen Wurm.
Müller is intriguingly specific about this hut in which the wanderer falls asleep. It is in eines Kühlers engem Haus, a charcoal burner's narrow dwelling, that he takes refuge. It is deep winter and the house, or rather the hut, is empty. But this non-encounter with an absent artisan only intensifies our sense of the protagonist's isolation. Over a period of millennia, charcoal burners were familiar denizens of the forest, plying their trade close to the supply of raw material, building great conical piles of wood around a central shaft, covering the whole structure with turf or clay, starting a fire at the bottom of the flue, and then tending and repairing the furnace as the fire carbonised the wood, driving out moisture and reducing it in volume by as much as a third. The kilning process would take weeks, and it was a skilled business with its own distinctive expertise. The experienced burner would know from the smell of smoke how his kiln was doing. It was unwise to depend too much on the colour of the vapours. It was seasonal too, which is why the hut in Winterreise is empty. The charcoal burner's hut is the simplest dwelling imaginable, a circular framework of around 12 wooden poles. These sloped inwards, teepee-like, this skeleton being then covered with turf, hides, thatch or cloth. It was, sure enough, a narrow dwelling, with a rough bed, made out of logs and straw and little else. A small charcoal fire would be kept burning near the door for heat. The conservation of the form of the charcoal burner's hut and the family nature of the occupation has suggested to some that this was a craft pursued by some sort of in-group who preserved and transmitted their traditions. Be that as it may, during the 1820s, charcoal burning must be seen as a liminal activity. These men were living on a social and on a historical boundary. Many burners were loners, most were at least outsiders, and from our perspective at least, the craft which they followed was in decline. The replacement of charcoal by coke is one of the markers of the Industrial Revolution, which accelerated in England in the mid-18th century. By 1788, two-thirds of the blast furnaces in Britain were using coke. German-speaking Central Europe lagged behind in this process, but already in 1810, Friedrich Krupp had built a pioneering steel foundry in Essen, producing smelted steel by 1816 and laying the foundations of what was to become, in the course of the 19th century, the world's largest industrial company. All this gives our absent charcoal burner quite a symbolic role in understanding the culture from which Winterreise emerged. Part of his appeal for us is the way he can summon up a lost way of life and an economy in flux. The other surprise, a much more hidden one, is that he might be giving us a secret political message, intended by Müller and, in all likelihood, adopted by Franz Schubert. In this winter time of post-Napoleonic repression in the German lands, in Prussian-dominated Dessau, Müller's hometown, as much as in Habsburg-ruled Vienna, Schubert's, political allegiances, personal and national, were shifting, complex and concealed. The Carlsbad decrees and the Vienna Final Acts, which followed, limiting constitutional government and requiring monarchical government for all states within the Federation, these were the keystones of the political regime under which both Müller and Schubert lived. No compromise with liberalism was conceivable for the powers that be. Any sort of social gathering was viewed with suspicion in Vienna, even the most apparently innocent. Youthful high spirits were suspect in this system later characterised as absolutism mitigated by sloppiness. Foreign travel was restricted to impose a degree of isolation from foreign innovation. Schubert's own encounters with this world of constraint, pedantry and doublethink were not inconsiderable. He ran into trouble with a few songs and with his German Mass, which used an unsanctioned translation. In 1817 and 1818, Müller travelled in Italy. The literary outcome was his book, Rome and Romans. Not a straightforward travel guide, but rather a series of glimpses into the life of a people, the hidden sides of Italian life and customs. Müller presented his own immersion in the charms of Italy as a distraction from the troubles of Europe at large. There was something disingenuous in this, however. Italy was alive with anti-Austrian feeling, channeled through the revolutionary Carbonari. Already in 1817, there had been revolts in the Papal States. And in 1820, the very year in which Müller's book on Rome appeared, revolution broke out in Naples, crushed by Habsburg forces in 1821. The second volume of Rome and Romans is prefaced by a letter to an old companion from Müller's sojourn in the Eternal City, the Swedish poet Per Daniel Atterbom. Its sentiments only confirm that emotional seesaw between unhappy resignation and a desire for action which possess so many in this political ice age. And so I greet you in your ancient and holy fatherland, not in the style of this book here, whose author has already become a stranger to me, joking and playing. No, earnestly and in brief, for the great Lent of the European world, that Easter week of suffering, anticipating and awaiting salvation, will not tolerate an indifferent shrug of the shoulders or flighty excuses and apologies. He who cannot act in this time can only be quiet and mourn. We can see now for the first time why our charcoal burner is there. We can decode what he signifies. He's not only an artisan plying his lonely trade, doomed by the harsh winds of socio-economic change, he's also one of the Carbonari, literally charcoal burners, the secret society feared by the Habsburg regime, and so much a part of the Italian landscape of the 1820s, which Müller had obliquely celebrated. For Müller, the Carbonari would have represented a commitment to constitutional government and resistance to the reactionary project which the Holy Alliance and its confederates were pursuing throughout Europe. They are those who, as in Müller's letter to Atterbom, can act, can strike out. The Winterreise of both Müller and Schubert is part of that quiescent mourning, which was all that was left to those who could not act. Singing the last words of Rast again, they emerge with a new rebellious ferocity, testament to the repressed energy and pain of those who did not dare to act.
Ian Bostridge reading and performing Schubert's Winter Journey. The pianist is Leif Uwe Ansnes. The book is abridged by Lawrence Waring and produced by Kirstine Cameron. In Woman's Hour, in a couple of minutes, the composer Judith Weir talks about her role as Master of the Queen's Music. We look back at the feminist controversies of the year and we'll hear from some of those involved in bringing Vera Brittain's First World War memoir, Testament of Youth, to the big screen. Then at 11, it's back to the 80s.
The strike itself will be over on Tuesday and there'll be a disciplined vote.
No!
On the day that secret government files from the mid-1980s are opened for the first time, Martha Carney will be joined in the studio by Roy Hattersley and Michael Heseltine.
We'll find out what was really happening behind the scenes in Margaret Thatcher's cabinet.
The Defence Secretary, Mr. Michael Heseltine, has resigned from the cabinet. He made the announcement to reporters as he stepped out of number 10.
UK Confidential on BBC Radio 4 this morning at 11 and then on the Radio 4 website.